Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 21st, 2012. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This week's lead article in the Triangle Business Journal is the 2012 Business Person of the Year, J. Adam Abram, Chairman of Franklin Holdings Limited. This article is entitled Multitasker, an Executive with the Knowledge, Imagination, and Drive to Build Thriving Businesses by Lee Weisbecker. A few yards away, in a string of offices on the north side of the building, Scott Custer and various lieutenants, men brought together and financed by Abram, busily implement their strategy to build a $5 billion-plus publicly traded statewide banking franchise that will be headquartered in this very location. Already four banks have been or are being swallowed up, and plans are afoot to turn the franchise, Vantage South, into an aggressive small business lender. As the energetic Custer produces document after document propelling the effort forward, 70 to 80% of the paper stream flows across the hall to pass under Abram's gaze. The papers come back, says Custer, not only having been read, but also digested and covered with margin comments that keep everyone, including the lawyers, on their toes. For Abram, the documents, the mission, the exploration into new professional territory, is a horizon expander that feeds one of his key drives, namely, what appears to be an almost insatiable curiosity. "It's not about the money," is how he explains it. "It's just that I like to know how things work and how they fit together." In the past 13 months, Adam has built a business that today boasts of almost $2 billion in assets by acquiring four banks. Out of the curiosity has grown a business executive with the knowledge, imagination, and drive needed to constantly build thriving businesses, making Adam Abram the choice as Triangle Business Journal's Business Person of the Year for 2012. Now 57, the tall Harvard University graduate surrounds himself in his office with art objects as varied as his interests. There's a portrait of Abraham Lincoln on an easel. "He's a guy I admire," says Abram, "and a 6-foot tall shield carved by a New Guinea headhunter. On one wall, a black-and-white photographic study of an Alaskan winterscape. On another, a photograph of a Durham street scene." As with his art, so Abram's past has defied a single track. A former journalist, Abram is a longtime board member of Human Rights First, a nonprofit with offices in Washington, D.C. and New York that battles discrimination and rails against international rights abuses. There is his position as trustee of the Washington-based Urban Institute, an organization that gathers social science data for policymakers while priding itself on its practice of omitting all the partisan noise. There was that time back in 2002 when, as a board member of the Durham-based Weekly Independent, he pushed for negotiations that led to the paper's purchase of the rival weekly, The Spectator, thereby ensuring Indy a future. Adam is not the calm center, is how paper's longtime publisher Steve Shule later recalled those days. He's the force of wind, pushing us to think bigger and reach higher and want more. Finally, there are Abram's board and committee memberships in such varied groups as the Triangle Land Conservancy, the Durham Arts Council, and the avowedly liberal American Civil Liberties Union. He is a man possessed of an activist streak that comes, no doubt, from the very household air that he breathed while growing up, first in Atlanta and then in New York in the 1960s. His father was attorney Morris Berthold Abram, who represented Martin Luther King Sr., the father of the famed civil rights activist and the U.S. Peace Corps. The elder Abram, who died in 2000, successfully argued before the U.S. Supreme Court in a case that led to the overturning of the county unit voting system in the South. struck down as contrary to one person, one vote, and thought to favor rural whites, county unit voting was a system that parceled out both popular votes and units to candidates who needed a majority of each to claim victory. And from 1968 through 1970, Morris Abrams served as president of Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts. Then, in junior high school, the younger Abram remembers the environs as a sort of boyhood playground. "We like to go see where Dad worked," he recalls. Attending Harvard from 1974 to 1978, the young Abram read history, not law, and with a degree in hand, he headed to North Carolina and hoped to land a job at a newspaper. While talks proceeded with the Charlotte Observer, he freelanced for The Nation, The Atlantic, and other publications, but soon found himself hard-pressed for cash. It was at this point that he turned away from the newspaper sector and launched a business career that 35 years later has led to his partnership with Custer and a foray into banking. Introduced by mutual friends, Abram and Custer met in 2009 in a restaurant in Chapel Hill's Meadowmont community. There, Custer, fresh off a stint as CEO of RBC Bank USA, on the back of a napkin sketched out the design of the holding company the two are now building. "I helped shape his thinking," recalls Custer, himself a Triangle Business Journal Business Person of the Year back in 2006. But Adam had already begun looking for deals. Much in Abram's business past had prepared him for the moment. For the late 1970s and through the 80s, he bought distressed commercial real estate from banks and then put it back on the market. The bonus, Abram explains, was getting the very same banks to help finance the deal. Next came historic property rehabs, including some of the first tobacco warehouse projects in Durham. Both were activities that gave him a window into how banks, especially at the community and regional bank levels, operate. By the 1990s, his focus had shifted to the insurance industry, first with the creation of Front Royal Insurance, a company focused on environmental coverage, and second with James River, a specialty insurer that he would take public in 2005 and operate for 5 years before bringing in an A-list of financial partners that took it private once again. That list included the likes of giant Goldman Sachs, the $27 billion total asset investment conglomerate at D.E. Shaw Group, and Elliott Capital, a large New York hedge fund. James River offers policies in a dozen areas to clients who would have difficulties finding coverage on conventional markets. Doctors, amusement parks, environmental contractors, medical device makers, and others. Employing more than 210 in North Carolina and Virginia, the company boasts nearly $480 million in written premiums and a 2011 net income of $39 million and a 10% growth rate year-to-date in 2012. Abrams' years in the insurance game left him with a long list of contacts in the financial services and investor community that are coming in handy now in his new environment. "He knows what he's doing," says Custer. "I know. I've followed him around New York." It was his continued interest in distressed real estate that, in a roundabout way, led Abram to banking. Intrigued by the portfolio holdings of a small, troubled Burlington-based community bank, Vantage South, Abram says he made a bid for the company. "That's where the distressed real estate was," he explains. "It was in the banks." Joining with Chapel Hill partner and longtime friend Steve Lerner, the two set up Piedmont Community Bank Holdings, an investment group itself backed by some deep-pocketed institutional investors. The partial list includes such names as Greenwich, Connecticut-based Stone Point Capital, New York-based Lightyear Capital, LLC, Harvard Management Company, and others. Success or failure comes, Abram says, from how well an entrepreneur positions himself or herself correctly in a wave, in other words, in the coming thing. Throughout his career, Abram's own positioning has included surrounding himself with the right people to get where he wants to go next. In the case of Piedmont and the banking foray, it meant bringing in Custer and other longtime banking vets, like Steve Jones, now president of Vantage South. Together, since 2009, in rapid order, they have purchased Vantage South, Bank of Rowan near Charlotte, Raleigh-based Crescent State Bank, and most recently, East Carolina Bank, or ECB, in Englehart. Once regulators approve the ECB acquisition, total assets will hit nearly $2 billion, and other acquisitions are in the works. Meanwhile, with Jones pushing the effort, the new bank entity, now called Vantage South, has turned itself into one of the most active U.S. Small Business Administration lenders in the state, behind only such big names as Winston-Salem-based BB&T and San Francisco-based Wells Fargo. And you will be seeing more of it, proclaims Jones. Both Abram and Custer point to the SBA record as proof of their motivations, namely not to cobble together a banking franchise for the purpose of flipping it or selling it for a nifty profit. That's not it, says Abram. We're going to have a bank that is going to last for a long time, he says. Right now we are focusing on the building blocks, but in the long run we are creating something that will last. This is an editor's note. The process of determining the business person of the year requires extensive research of a candidate's accomplishments and his or her role in our community. To read up on this year's process, please visit trianglebusinessjournal.com and click on the Business Person of the Year feature. Next up, United Way unveils change in funding plan by Jason DeBrune. This article is from Raleigh. The United Way of the Greater Triangle wants more measurable outcomes from the agencies it funds and will likely replace certain agencies with others that more closely align with its goals. For the first time in at least a decade, the United Way is going through a major reapplication process and has opened the door to any nonprofit organization in the Triangle. Some 40 agencies that don't receive funding filed new applications. New CEO Mac Kuntz says he and the board must still make the final decisions, but estimated that between 20 and 10 agencies could be replaced. At the same time, and not coincidentally, the United Way is narrowing its focus on what community impact it wants to have. Historically, the mission of the United Way has been somewhat broad, but its leaders want to focus specifically on financial stability, education, and health, particularly for low-income families. Achieving those goals will change the individual lives and strengthen communities, says Walter Davenport, chairman of the United Way board. In talking about the changes, both Kuntz and Davenport repeatedly use the term community outcomes, and they say they want to flip how they think about dispersing donations. Stretching out his arms and pointing his hands towards each other to highlight the flow of donations, Kuntz shakes his left hand and says the United Way has historically thought about itself as aggregating donations first, then deciding where to distribute those donations second. He leaves that hand up, but while shaking the other hand, he says that the United Way should instead start with thinking about the end point, the community impact it wants to have, and work backwards towards the donor, symbolized by his first hand. The shift is resonating with donors. J.R. Sharon, managing partner at the Raleigh office of accounting firm Deloitte, says he never had concerns that donations were being misused, but thinks it's the right time to see if there are better ways to allocate donor money. It's a chance to open the doors to some other agencies that may be doing a little better or hitting the needs of the community a little more on point, he says, especially at a time when needs outpace funds at such a high level. Of course, the United Way has always vetted its agencies and made new funding decisions each year, points out Kevin Trapani, CEO of the Redwoods Group in Morrisville and a United Way board member. Still, the broad push this year is bigger than in recent memory and is more tightly focused. He wants donors to think of the United Way like a social impact mutual fund, in which they can trust the board to allocate the money to have the most impact on achieving its goals. That will mean that some agencies who have received funding in the past will see a reduced amount, or maybe nothing at all. That doesn't mean they won't receive any help, however. Trapani wants the United Way to think of itself not just as a way to aggregate and disperse financial capital, but intellectual and social capital as well. Someone who runs an information technology startup probably lives on a tight budget, but can help an area nonprofit set up a better computer system, for example. That's a connection the United Way should facilitate, Trapani says. The United Way campaign is on track to raise $16.3 million this year, slightly less than the year before, and will make final disbursement decisions in early 2013. Continuing inside the front cover, land leases abundant in Wake County, by Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Raleigh. If you build something on someone else's land, chances are your legal rights of owning that property could be challenged. For real estate developers, that uncertainty generally prevents them from getting financing from lenders and negotiating deals with other partners. But records from Wake County show several prominent office buildings, research facilities, and retail centers have been developed under ground lease arrangements, arguably making land lease deals more common here than anywhere in North Carolina. Observers cite the rising value of property in Wake County, one of the fastest-growing counties in the nation, as one of the primary reasons why property owners are reluctant to sell prime land and instead are choosing to get paid for it every year for years to come. The city of Raleigh's 75-year pact with the state of North Carolina relating to the Dorothea Dix land in downtown Raleigh was the latest example of such a deal. Nearly 14,000 acres, or 2.6% of the land in Wake County, has at least one leasehold obligation, according to a review of County Revenue Department property records. The leasehold number is more than doubled when accounting for the 17,000-plus acres owned by the federal government near Falls Lake in Wake County. Leasehold is the term accountants use to split the property tax obligation for the land value separate from the tax obligation for the building or other improvements. Other leasehold properties involve acreage owned by quasi-government entities and university groups that want to maintain control over what type of real estate is constructed and what private companies are allowed to operate on the property. Raleigh-Durham International Airport is one example. Another example is North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus, which has allowed select real estate investors to build and manage several privately owned office and research facilities on the campus to attract corporate partners to work alongside its faculty, staff, and students. We know we're going to be here for the long term, and this allows us to get the ground lease income and also get programmatic value from the tenants that come to these buildings, says Harlan Stafford, Director of Real Estate for the Centennial Campus Development Office. Land leases can also have tax advantages for private sector property owners, says Schmeed Zlork, President of York Properties in Raleigh. Property owners pay taxes only on annual lease income, rather than on the capital gains that would result from a sale of the property. Plus, it gives them an annuity type of income, he says. For the lessee, not having to front the money to acquire the land is an advantage. York Properties is still managing at least two retail properties on land leases in the triangle that York's father, Willie York, helped negotiate decades ago. Mission Valley Shopping Center on Western Boulevard in Raleigh and Village Square Shopping Center on Carytown Boulevard in Cary. But land lease deals can create complications in the long term. The former Wachovia office building at 227 Fayetteville Street in downtown Raleigh, for example, has suffered the consequences of a land lease that was negotiated more than 50 years ago. Wachovia Bank, now Wells Fargo, had leased the land from two New York investors and occupied an 11-story building on the site for more than 40 years. But it vacated the building following the 2003 bank merger and the lure of a higher-profile office tower down the street. Owners of 227 Fayetteville reverted back to the landowners in 2011, but that also shifted responsibility for maintaining the building back to the heirs of the New York landowners. Sources say they expect the building to be sold to a new development group, which is also from New York, before the end of the year. Ron Gibson, a veteran Raleigh real estate investor and retired CEO of Highwoods Properties, says he usually avoids properties on land leases. The only reason to agree to a lease is if you have a ground zero location and the owner won't sell. Gibson noted that the Becana apartments and several of the office buildings near it on Glenwood Avenue are still operating on the long-term ground leases. Through GST Investments, LLC, Garland S. Tucker, Jr. still owns the land under the 3600 Glenwood Avenue and 3605 Glenwood Avenue office buildings, as well as the Paragon Bank building down the street. Jack Coggins still owns the land under the Bacana and the 3737 Glenwood Avenue building, built by Highwoods. "The only reason I got involved in land leases, period, was if I couldn't buy the land," Gibson says. "I was part of a group that bought Bacana a few years ago, renovated it, and sold it again, and I could have done a lot better if I had owned the land." Still inside the front cover, time crunch, small businesses beef up cash reserves during the holidays. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Black Friday is so named for being the day when retailers supposedly begin to turn an annual profit. But the 6 weeks that follow are crucial for a wide and possibly growing range of businesses. That includes companies that serve the retail sector, of course, and also numerous service industries from restaurants to personal care. A visit from in-laws may entail a visit from a housekeeper, but it may also mean they'll take you out to dinner one night. Workplaces and neighbors host holiday parties, a source of seasonal business for caterers, salons, and decorators. Small business owners say it can be overwhelming, fun, and lucrative all at once. "It's crazy," says Colleen Speaks, who owns Posh Nosh Catering on Capitol Boulevard near downtown Raleigh. On a recent Monday afternoon in her home salon in Raleigh's Five Points neighborhood, salon owner Carla Ray greeted client Wendy Stevenson as she finished up crimson highlights and Charlotte Englehart's hair. She dried Englehart's hair, then disappeared for a moment to get a glass of wine for Stevenson as Englehart changed out of the salon robe. Ree says she's booked with appointments from 9:30 a.m. to 8 p.m. in December, compared to a 10-7 schedule throughout most of the year. "I definitely push it," Ray says. "I'm surprised how many hours I can work." Ray says many of her clients, men and women alike, themselves own businesses in the service sector, and many of those have filed into the salon to look their best for year-end functions. Sales representatives, meanwhile, want to look their best so they can step up their games as the year starts. The end-of-the-year rush shows up in a wide range of economic data, starting with monthly job reports from the state and federal agencies. The Triangle's unemployment rate has historically fallen by an average of about 0.3 percentage points in November, another 0.1% or so in December, and then risen again in January. The November and December reports have usually shown the retail and distribution sector adding the most jobs, while a category known as professional and business services has also grown substantially. The manufacturing and distribution sectors have grown markedly more efficient in the last 15 years through just-in-time delivery and other practices. Jay Swathaning, a UNC Chapel Hill business professor who studies supply chains, says the efficiency has shifted a noticeable amount of economic activity from September and October into November and December. While that means a mad rush for more people in the last couple of months of the year, it has also allowed the sector to limit the inventory that goes to waste. Retailers of all stripes can order products even after Black Friday as they see what's selling and what isn't. Wendy McMillan-Smith says her shop, Cameron's Gallery in Chapel Hill, has made a niche as a place to buy gifts at the last minute, adding the last 10 days before Christmas makes a huge difference in the store's annual profitability. "It's sort of a nail-biter," she says. And now, Cowell's Outfit invests in local private equity concern. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. Credit Suisse has committed $143.5 million, roughly 61% of the $232 million North Carolina Innovation Fund, with a stable of four in-state money managers helping to scout investments. State Treasurer Janet Cowell, who oversees North Carolina's $77 billion pension system, set up the fund and tapped Credit Suisse as the overall manager back in 2010, looking to spur homegrown startups when possible. The four outside money managers, the latest tapped being Raleigh-based NovaQuest Capital Management, are the conduits that actually funnel the money out to individual companies in the field. CAL spokeswoman Julia Vail says to date the Innovation Fund has made 11 co-investments through the four outside managers. Names of the companies on the receiving end of the state taxpayer cash and their geographic locations are not disclosed. The three other outside money managers in the effort are Durham-based Hatteras Venture Partners and two Charlotte-based private equity investors, Frontier Capital and Carousel Capital, the latter being a firm set up by former UNC System President Erskine Bowles. Treasurer's office records indicate that the pace of Innovation Fund investing has picked up and in recent months. As of June 30, 2011, only $38 million, or 16% of the money, had been drawn for investment purposes. What investments had been made up to that point were too new to show any returns, according to those records, the latest available. The state had paid out $1.6 million in management fees on the project for the 12 months ending June 30th of that year. Asked to comment on the 61% commitment level, California-based private equity expert Joel Block says there is no hard and fast rule in such matters. Managers, he says, have to walk a fine line. The money can't make a return when it's sitting in the bank, says Block, but at the same time, they have to be cautious in their approach. In selecting NovaQuest, innovation fund managers are opening a direct door to life sciences, specifically biopharmaceutical startups. Initially set up as the investment arm of Durham-based clinical research giant Quintiles, NovaQuest charted an independent course for itself back in 2010, licensed the name, and kept Quintiles as a minority stakeholder. Most of the firm's senior managers, including Ron Wooten and John Bradley, are former senior Quintiles executives who scouted new investments while working under the Quintiles umbrella. Contacted about the Innovation Fund connection, Wooten had no comment. The investment firm does not carry a list of its portfolio companies on its website. Hatteras, the other Triangle-based manager on the receiving end of the Innovation Fund, is also scouting life science deals. Next up, financial turmoil puts kibosh on new bank startups. Community bankers forecast little chance for bank startups for another 3 years. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Raleigh. The arrival of 2013 will mark 5 years since there was a bank startup anywhere in the Triangle, or in all of North Carolina, for that matter. The funk that's enveloped banking since the financial panic of 2008 has evaporated in most parts of the industry, but not at the startup level. New community banks, which were popping up right and left here and across North Carolina in the mid to late 2000s, just haven't been happening. And don't look for any new ones anytime soon, seems to be the industry consensus. We don't see any on the horizon, says Thad Woodard, CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association. Someday, down the line, we'll see some new banks chartered in North Carolina. There are plain and simply too many dynamic communities across our state without a hometown bank. Of the last two Triangle startups, Durham-based KeySource Commercial and Raleigh-based Trust Atlantic, both were founded back in 2007. KeySource recently disappeared, acquired by Bank of North Carolina, in a wave of consolidation now sweeping the industry. Meanwhile, Jim Beck's Trust Atlantic is alive and well, growing and showing profits. It's been the general lack of investor interest in the community bank stocks at the retail level that's worked to put the brakes on the startup, says Beck. There's that, and also the question of whether you could even get a new bank approved, he adds. Asked if Trust Atlantic, now with $370 million in total assets, might itself disappear in the consolidation wave now afoot, Beck says he has no plans to sell. At the same time, he adds, looking for ways to get bigger is a priority. And it might make sense at some point to sell to somebody bigger. In the meantime, like other bankers, he expects the startup drought to continue, perhaps as long as another 3 years. According to North Carolina Banking Commission records, regulators approved six new community banks back in 2008. The final one was Coastal Bank and Trust in Jacksonville, which received its go-ahead in September of that year and actually opened its doors in April 2009, says Commission spokeswoman Hai Nguyen. Beginning its existence with total assets of $28 million, it is $66 million now, according to the Federal Department Insurance Corporation. The other banks in the class of 2008 include Live Oak Bank in Wilmington, Premier Commercial in Greensboro, and Pisgah Community Bank in Asheville. Pisgah, now with $27 million in total assets, has posted losses of $1.5 million year-to-date through September 30th and operates under a federal regulatory consent order. What state regulators have approved since 2008 has been only the opening of a couple of trust company offices in the state and the conversion of Morganton Savings Bank from a federal savings and loan to a state savings bank. When will this turn around? Asked Raleigh attorney Tony Guetta, whose practice used to include startups. Not anytime soon, he says. Scattered across the landscape, he adds, are community banks still struggling to rid themselves of troubled assets and others still holding funds in the Trouble Asset Relief Program, or TARP, which the U.S. Treasury wants to wind down. All of that will require a cleanup that will have to get further down the road before the bank startups once again become the order of the day. And now, A Researcher's Quest to Make Household Products Safer, by Lauren K. Onisorge, from Raleigh. A North Carolina State University scientist is working to make chemicals safer. Heather Pattisall, assistant professor of biology, is part of a group led by Pete Myers, CEO and founder of Charlottesville, Virginia-based Environmental Health Sciences, that hopes to develop a test that can determine whether products contain endocrine disruptors before they hit the market. The protocol under development, Tiered Protocol for Endocrine Disruption, or TIPED, was recently presented in a paper published in the Royal Society of Chemistry's Green Chemistry. Traditional testing doesn't do a good job, Pattisall, one of the authors, explains. At NC State, she has been helping create a platform that can help the next generation of chemists avoid history's mistakes. Much of the endocrine effects are discovered after a product hits the market. One example is BPA, a plastic agent that has been found to disrupt hormones, which was commonly used in baby bottles until the FDA banned that use this year. What BPA does, it turns genes on and off, Myers explains, adding that in animal testing, BPA was found to cause several disorders, among them obesity, prostate cancer, and diabetes. Endocrinologists knew as far back as 1936 that BPA was a synthetic sex hormone, he says. So why is it still in plastic? Because science is so siloed that the process to enable communication, those mechanisms, hasn't existed, he says. What we've done to create it so the next generation of materials are developed with that sort of wisdom. Endocrine disruptors are found in everything from pesticides to shampoos to flame retardants, Pattisall says. The idea is to develop products right now, in the beginning, before they hit the market, she notes. If a company or an entrepreneur or a green chemist wanted to develop a chemical or a product, and they were fairly confident it would not endocrine disruptive, TIPED would be a way for them to test it. The system has five different tiers, varying so as to accommodate multiple industry needs. One is a computer modeling-based system, for example, where chemists can run their chemicals through a series of computer models. Two involve direct animal testing. Depending on your goal and where you are in research and development, you can jump in on any tier, she says. Myers says that while the project is in beta, he hopes companies will go ahead and sign on so they can add their own input to the protocol. The science is changing fast, he says, adding that TIPED will be updated as new discoveries are made. Karen Peabody O'Brien, executive director of Charlottesville-based Advancing Green Chemistry and a project advisor, says TIPED isn't just satisfying environmentalists. It is also meeting a consumer need, she says, noting the consumer push for BPA-free labeling. People buying things that affect their kids want to be as sure as they can of what they're putting in front of their families. And she adds that the push for non-endocrine disrupting chemicals as a positive economic as well as environmental effects. While BPA is not allowed in baby bottles and has not been declared a toxic substance in the U.S., there's controversy still surrounding the substance toxicity, Myers says. TPID grants thus far have totaled more than $500,000 and have come from the National Institute of Environmental Health and Safety, the Cedar Tree Foundation, Forsythia Foundation, the Johnson Family Foundation, the Candida Fund, and the John Merck Fund, and anonymous donors. And now the small business profile. This week, thrifty office furniture. To survive, the owner stopped paying himself for 16 months. This article is by Lee Weisbecker, and it's from Durham. If you really want to know how the economy is doing, ask Joel Gillis, owner and president of Durham-based Thrifty Office Furniture. When companies expand, move, or refit, they need what Gillis has in abundance in his showroom and warehouses. When they are sitting tight, the phones at the Thrifty don't ring as often. These days, Gillis reports they are ringing at a brisk pace, both at his Triangle facility and at the firm's operation in Wilmington. When did the turnaround start? It first crossed my mind back in mid-2011, he says. Then this year has been just phenomenal. How good? We are setting records, says office manager and HR administrator Joel Fuller. The main Thrifty showroom sits in a large building on Highway 70 on Durham's east side and is chocked full of everything office, from cubicles, desks, and chairs, to basketball and Hurricanes art for the corporate wall. The Hoops artwork is ecumenical. Images of Roy Williams and Dean Smith hang near large color photos of Cameron Indoor Stadium. Walk-in trade is welcome, but it's not Thrifty's focus. Designing, planning, and then delivering the goods for corporate outfits of any size is what pays the bills at the nearly 20-year-old firm. The dollar range on most of the jobs typically runs a scale from $5,000 to $50,000, though Gillis has planned and outfitted multi-building projects where the price tag topped $500,000. On track to bring in $4 million in revenue this year, Thrifty is the HON dealer for the Triangle and Wilmington, but offers a range of products from Lazy Boy, Abco, High Point, and other furniture makers. Used furniture is another revenue stream. Gillis, in his late 40s, is a Durham native who worked a decade for another office furniture dealer before going on his own in 1993. By 2008, he says, the time for expansion seemed right. I wanted to take this to the next level, recalls Gillis, who added a 30,000-square-foot warehouse and Wilmington showroom to his assets. The Thrifty staff at the time was 18. A short 2 months after the buildup was completed, the economy tanked. You couldn't have seen it coming, he says, reporting that sales plunged by 30%. Despite the drop, Gillis waited months before trimming the staff by four, and for 16 months he denied himself a paycheck. The cut I took myself came first, he recalls. Over 10 years I'd had my ups and downs like everyone else, but this time, when the economy didn't seem to get any better, I had to lay people off, and it gave me some sleepless nights. The Durham warehouse and Wilmington showroom he held on to, however, against the day when the sun would resume shining. When I get in the middle of something, I'm a committed person, and I don't give up, he says. The rapidly increasing pace of incoming calls at Thrifty indicate that his persistence is paying off. Even sales volumes in Wilmington, hard hit by the housing bust, are on the upswing. One of his repeat Port City customers are TV and movie production companies. The economy is not like it was back in 05, 06, or 07, Gillis says. We've been growing in recent months, and it's been because we are taking more market share. That's how we see ourselves moving forward. But to do it that way, you really have to focus on customer service and be on top of your game. This week's family business column is written by Mr. James Lee. Mr. Lee is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and a family business speaker, author, and advisor. This article is entitled Reflecting on Family Business Conversations. The Christmas tree went up at my house a few days ago with a minimum of fuss and frustration. Unlike some past years, I found myself humming happily instead of muttering darkly as I untangled strings of lights, juggled fragile glass ornaments, and shooed the cat out of the branches for the fifth time. My spirits had been boosted by conversations I'd had with family business owners about their holiday experiences and plans. My friend Patrick said, "This Christmas we put up a special decoration in front of our store. Nothing fancy, but it's got a manger scene and a menorah. It respects both traditions, and everybody in the family and the neighbors like it. But get this. Here in the season of goodwill toward men, we got a registered letter from some organization telling us we couldn't display religious symbols on religious holidays. They said we were violating the rights of people who have other beliefs or no beliefs at all, and they threatened to drag us into court if we didn't tear everything down within 48 hours. We got the family together to figure out what to do. My cousin Robert reminded everyone that we celebrate Hanukkah and Christmas because a couple of thousand years ago, some people didn't back down when they were threatened. We all decided that we aren't going to back down either. The employees say they feel like family and they'll stand by us, chip in to help pay a fine or whatever. So maybe we'll all end up in court. But we'll have a great holiday first, with our very own decoration in the front of the store. My friend Melissa made my day when I dropped by Miss Renewal, her salon, to wish her happy holidays. Let me tell you something, sport, Melissa said. That Santa Claus stuff is for real. Business was so bad the past couple of years that I thought I'd decorate this Christmas by putting a stringy little tree and a closed for good sign on the front window. But I kept thinking, hold on. This is my family's business and I don't want to let it go. Something good is going to happen. Something good can't describe it. On December 3rd, a man waltzes in here and says he'll invest big money in my little shop if I'll be partners with him to open a string of franchise misrenewals around this part of the country. The lawyers have looked over the deal, and it's golden. And that franchise man wouldn't even wear a red suit. My friend Harry tells a wonderful story. For years, our company has employed a top-notch parts manager. With Charlie on the job, there are no missing parts in the customer's orders. Since 2003, Charlie has organized a company carol sing each Christmas. He sent out reminders around Halloween and never got discouraged, not even when my mother, who owns the business, turned up her nose and told him that our choir of welders, mechanics, secretaries, and truck drivers is to Christmas caroling what a clothes dryer full of baseballs is to Brahms' lullaby. Every Christmas, we made the rounds to the shelters and other places where folks don't hear much singing at Christmas. Charlie always stood on the truck bumper and waved his arms like a conductor. Charlie's Army Reserve unit got deployed, so he wasn't here to organize the singing for a couple of years. And then he came home from Afghanistan with a few of his own parts missing. He returned to work, but some of us wondered if he'd ever be the same old Charlie. The week after Thanksgiving, the employees found their mailboxes stuffed with red and green papers announcing the carol sing. The old Charlie was back. Baseballs, huh? Charlie told my mother with a grin. We're going to sound like the Tabernacle Choir this year. This year, Charlie sits in a wheelchair and waves his one arm. Our choir never paid attention to his conducting when they could see him, so they shouldn't care if they can't see him now, right? But this year, the singers in the front decided to kneel down so the ones in the back can see Charlie waving his arm. The kneeling goes very well with Christmas carols sung by a bunch of loud, tone-deaf, happy singers, including, for the first time, my mother, led by a guy who is short a few parts, but still has the one that matters most at Christmas, a great big heart. Best wishes to families and business everywhere for the happiest of holidays. This week's Editor's Notebook column is from the editor of the Triangle Business Journal, Sugata Mukherjee, and it's entitled, 2012 was interesting, 2013 holds promise. As we close out yet another year, looking back to review the year in terms of business stories, executive happenings, and corporate milestones always puts things in perspective. In the final weeks of December, we worked through three issues with distinctive content. Our announcement of the 2012 Business Person of the Year, the 2012 Top Stories Edition, and the 10 People to Watch issue which will be the first edition in 2013. While planning all these issues, we are forced to take inventory of what happened during the year, who excelled at his or her job, and the people we should be watching closely next year. As you read our 2012 TBJ Business Person of the Year feature on J. Adam Abram this week, or listen to it on the Triangle Radio Reading Service, get a feel for why we chose him to be the most important person in business in the Triangle this year. Abram is building a local bank holding company that one day could compete with the likes of Bank America, Wells Fargo, and BB&T for loans, deposits, and investments. He's not there yet, but he's laying the groundwork of establishing a structure that can only be beneficial to the Triangle business community. He has former RBC USA President Scott Custer to help him chart the growth course. It was Custer's push that led to RBC making that $100 million commitment to build the downtown building. And it was Custer's persistence that persuaded RBC to sign an $80 million naming rights deal with the Centennial Authority almost 10 years ago. If local companies succeed in their strategy, the entire community benefits. But sometimes things in the corporate world are simply not that easy. When we start looking at the top stories of the year, two things jumped out at us: the Progress-Duke merger debacle and the WakeMed-UNC fight for RECs coming to an end. Those were big developments that have a broader impact on our communities. The Duke Progress saga may actually end up benefiting folks in the Triangle in the form of better electric rates and short-term community development dollars. The downside, of course, was that the Triangle lost yet another headquarters operation. Out of the WakeMed-UNC fight, Wake County benefited in the end as UNC agreed to invest $40 million into the county's mental health operation that includes developing and operating a 28-bed inpatient psychiatric facility. Next week, you will hear about other stories that made our top 10 list. And finally, we were excited to come up with a list of 10 people we should be watching closely next year, keeping success, challenges, and community impact in mind. As you read through these three issues of the paper, I hope you are as thankful as I am that we live in a community where things are happening, people are building, people are thinking, and people are helping. That's put everything we do in perspective. Happy holidays. And a happy new year. This week's guest column is from Mr. Thad Woodard. Mr. Woodard is the president and CEO of the North Carolina Bankers Association. This article is entitled "The Corporate Lessons from Life of Pi." In the aftermath of the 2012 national elections, I've heard the cheers and seen the tears so broadly dispersed across the faces of those who voted for Barack Obama or Mitt Romney. To say that the Obama contingent is ecstatic would not come close to describing their euphoria. The devastation and hopelessness expressed by the Romney advocates makes one think of the piteous cries arising from the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy all along the shores of devastated New Jersey and New York. What will we do, and how will we ever be able to come together to strengthen the America that is home for us all? That remains to be seen. It will be a daunting task for our president and for those who are sworn in and take their seats as members of the 113th United States Congress. It seems safe to conclude that we can't go forward using the same methods of advancement employed over the last 4 years. There's not a grain of hope for us if we can't find ways to work together for the benefit of every one of us today and those who are to follow us in the tomorrows that lie ahead for this great country. Losing an election is a bitter thing. I've been there more than once. You put your whole self into it, and you feel so desperately abandoned when those you viewed as adversarial have gained or retained the reins. Your first inclination is to be very, very angry, and then you move into complacency as you throw your hands up and exclaim, "Oh, what the hell, I tried. They'll see I was right." Meanwhile, the winners are gloating and claiming their victory to be a mandate. I believe there is no mandate, and there is no reason to pick up your ball and go home. In a probable sense, we have arrived at a jumping-off point. somewhat like the much-discussed fiscal cliff. It's a time in the history of our beloved America when we must absolutely come face-to-face with each other, no matter our political preferences, in order to work out the perilous problems that have led us to this precarious precipice upon which we all stand, every single one of us. In the movie Life of Pi, young Pi rescues a large Bengal tiger from the sinking Japanese merchant ship, Tsingtsum. The whole movie focuses on just how in this world do you deal with a tiger sharing your lifeboat for 227 days. You can't push him overboard. The beast weighs no less than 450 pounds. Even if you succeeded, tigers are accomplished swimmers, and he would probably be less friendly after such a forceful swim. You can't kill him, and you probably shouldn't even try because failure would have tragic consequences. You can't outlive him. The tiger will likely survive longer than you without fresh water, and when he runs out of food, there's always you. Pi is left with only one option, to tame the tiger. The only way to do that is to provide it with food and fresh water, obtained by fishing and gathering rainwater and consistently making sure he understands the limit of his territory. The results are fascinating and often spellbinding. I correlate this movie, currently showing in a theater near you, with the plight of our nation. President Obama is Pi. He has pulled the tiger into the lifeboat with him. In order to survive, each must respect the other. They must know the territory occupied by each other. It is a natural instinct that each will defend his territory, yet, no matter how long their solemn voyage, the survival of each depends on the survival of the other. If one kills his opponent by force or by devouring him, he, too, is certain to die. The voyage may last a long, long time, but these two sailors, often cast as natural enemies, can make landfall. They can discover a new land and place themselves, along with their precious cargo, on the shores of a new frontier. Even then, they are likely to go on their separate ways, and probably will confront each other from time to time because of their different survival strategies. But when the story is told again and again for the generations yet to come, its message will be that they did work together in order to overcome the obstacles, to break the gridlock, and to set a course together for a new beginning. Statesmen must be willing to apply the art of practical compromise in order to attack the problem that is bigger than their fear of each other. Together they can and must find ways to slay the beast that would devour us all. Next up, and the winner is a Girl Scout troop from the Triad. And the winner? Well, it's the bottom half of a mannequin. The folks over at Keep North Carolina Beautiful held a contest to see who could uncover the strangest litter during the Great American Cleanup and the North Carolina Department of Transportation's litter sweep. In what was dubbed as the Unusual Litter Contest, Keep North Carolina Beautiful doled out cash prizes for what it considered to be the oddest litter. First place and a $250 prize went to Girl Scout Troop 40109 of Winston-Salem for the bottom half of a mannequin. Second place and $100 went to Cub Scout Pack 318 of North Raleigh United Methodist Church for the discovery of a perfect condition canoe paddle. And third place and $50 went to Girl Scout Troop 799 of Huntersville for uncovering a toilet seat. The Triangle Business Journal has just one question. Where's the other half of the mannequin? Good thing there are plenty of urgent care centers these days because the holidays bring plenty of injuries. The most common, says Doctors Express, a nationally franchised urgent care operation with a center in Cary, are falls from ladders while decorating and cuts from ornaments. Here are some factoids courtesy of Doctors Express. More than 13,000 people were treated in ERs during 2010 holiday season, the latest available data. That was up from 12,000 in 2009. Also, more than 250,000 people were treated in emergency rooms due to toy-related accidents in 2010, according to the Consumer Product Safety Commission. And About 181,500 children younger than 15 were treated in U.S. hospital emergency departments due to toy-related injuries in 2010, says the Center for Public Safety. And the biggest bane ever invented in packaging, that hard plastic that wraps around toys, electronics, and all manner of stuff, is big-time dangerous. So much so, in fact, that dealing with it can induce what's being called wrap rage. And U.S. Census Bureau research shows that people suffer 2 times more injuries from trying to open packaging than from skateboards or swimming pools. In fact, an average of 6,000 people a year go to the emergency room due to packaging-related injuries, says the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Go figure. For the past 11 springs, the Sanford Pottery Festival has attracted thousands of visitors to Lee County, but festival organizers have announced there will be no festival in 2013. So, a group of Sanford business and civic leaders is working to create a new festival to replace it called Sanford Arts and Vines Festival. Planners say the new festival will still feature local pottery, and it will expand to include other locally produced arts and crafts, wines, food, and music. The new festival date and location will remain the same, the weekend before Mother's Day at the Dennis A. Wicker Civic Center. There's good news coming to the first tee of the Triangle. TBJ hears Johnson & Johnson has agreed to a $37,000 grant for the Triangle chapter with a 2-to-1 matching grant from First Tee's corporate office. First Tee Director of Development Pat Nelly says if the group manages to raise another $11,000 by the end of the year, Johnson & Johnson will kick in an additional $5,500. Nelly says the majority of the proceeds from these grants will go to fund additional scholarships for children in underserved communities. Nelly adds Johnson & Johnson has agreed to participate in this grant program for 3 years. And finally, mobile software company Myco is on track to increase its revenue by 25% in 2012. That's according to a statement issued by the firm that says the developer, which helps organize such as the USDA Implement Mobile Data Collection System software on mobile devices, is on a growth trajectory. Myco is based in Durham and helps its users create easy electronic forms and workflow management systems. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at triangleReadingService.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next year.